Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
don't you know we're gonna
Started to burn too many things we found. This is Harvey Wasserman back at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We've got three great guests, really powerful experts in the field of renewable energy today, starting with Scott Sklar. We're going to talk about the overview of what's happening with the lunatic Donald Trump in the White House, pushing coal, pushing oil, pushing gas, God, and pushing nuclear, for God's sakes. We also have the bankruptcy of Westinghouse, a huge deal happening right now. Scott Sklar, are you with us?
I sure am, but you got to say huge with a huge deal.
Yeah, it is a huge deal. God, it's something else. I mean, Westinghouse was the pioneer, one of the original pioneers of the nuclear power industry. About half the world's nuclear power plants were built by Westinghouse. Westinghouse historically was actually the first major utility to get involved with electric power. They got the contract to take the power from Niagara Falls. When Niagara Falls was first pioneered as an electric generating source, there was a bidding war between J.P. Morgan and Thomas Edison versus George Westinghouse and Nikola Tesla, and Westinghouse won. Of course, Morgan then threatened to sue Westinghouse, and Westinghouse had to sell out the whole deal. But nonetheless, here they are 100 years later going bankrupt. So, Scott, introduce yourself with your credentials. And then explain to us what you think is really happening now in the world of energy.
Well, I've been in the clean energy field for 40 years, and for the last 16 run a company that blends all of the clean energy technologies all over the world. And I also teach two interdisciplinary courses on sustainable energy at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. So, and I have two buildings that are off the grid. So an office and my home. And my D.C. office has a great mixed module PV system overlooking Lafayette Park in front of the White House, no less. So that's who I am. And
well, you better be careful, Scott, because Trump could launch an attack on your solar panels.
He might. You know, and I also have a long beard, and I understand he doesn't allow bearded people in prominent positions in the administration. So I feel doubly under threat. But what's happening is actually not too different of what happened in the 1970s when the federal courts broke up AT&T. And the AT&T first and then the Ma Bells tried to fight independent communication companies like MCI and put on a whole campaign against cellular technology on the whole goal that who would spend 15 times more for a unit of communication when we have excellent 99.7% quality service. So here we have a monopoly system on energy, and they have a sweetheart deal, and they make most of their money building huge, and I say huge, generation plants, and they have very complicated, pretty much behind-the-scenes regulation. They like to keep it complicated, and then they fight any chance for competition. And in, of course, the more sophisticated states that have more open processes and more analysis, they have had to open up their grids and do demand energy efficiency. It's always less expensive to save energy than generate it, but of course they don't make money on that. And then of course they're, one of their biggest deals is to block residential solar in particular, because they're losing money on that too. So many states and many organizations have been working with regulators in the states to allow, create renewable energy portfolio standards and tax incentives, and to do value of solar or value of distributed generation, which includes all the renewables, studies to show how it benefits the electric grid, very similar as how distributed communications actually adds value to the communications grid. Or if we didn't have that, you'd all be walking around with rotary and push-button telephones with long wires, which is
right.
Very difficult in your car. So
all those people,
that's
all
the
those
fight.
People.
It's the fight over money. It's the fight over access. It's the fight against monopolies and opening up the system. And frankly, it's a fight for many of us who believe in low to zero water use, low emissions, low waste energy system.
And it's also, you know, it's a battle over technological survival. I mean, you know, the United States wants the world, first of all these wonderful renewable technologies that Trump is and the Koch brothers are trying to destroy were developed here. And now picked up, you know, the first PV cell, photovoltaic cell, was at the Bell Labs in 53. Wind power, well, you got to give credit to some other countries for the wind power. But in the 70s and early 80s, there were more than 90% of the world's windmills were in California, thanks to Jerry Brown. And
right.
Now these technologies are owned and operated. They're dominated by other countries. And the analogy I use, by the way, I just had a piece with Tim Judson posted at EcoWatch, a wonderful green website edited by Stephanie Spear, on the situation in New York, where we have the liberal Democratic governor handing $7.5 billion to Exelon to run four dying nuclear reactors, two of which were opened in the 60s, for God's sakes. You know, what's happened is that the U.S. develops all these fantastic technologies and then runs away from them. And as a result, I mean, our future competitiveness is really in question here. It's mind-boggling what's happening. The advances in renewables are spectacular, and we have a president in the White House who's trying tooth and nail to fight them off. It's mind-boggling.
It is mind-boggling. It is very hard to be... live in this town and listen to this nonsense.
Yeah. Amit Ronan, have you joined us?
I have. Hi, Harvey. Thanks
Good.
For having
hey,
me
Hey, how are you? And Dan Jewell, are you with us?
I am, Harvey.
Hey. All right, what a group here. Four of us, we can actually play bridge. Amit, Ronan, if you will identify yourself as being someone in addition to being my nephew, tell us you have a great position at George Washington and are a leader in the solar industry. So tell us your credentials and what you think about what Trump is doing, and especially in light of the Westinghouse bankruptcy, and then we'll get to you, Dan.
Okay. Well, I head up a solar energy research institute here at George Washington University, and we focus primarily on the public policy barriers to solar energy. And it's been, to put it mildly, an interesting couple years here. I mean, Scott's seen it all in the last 40 years, but things have really taken off in the last few years, and mostly in a good way, I would say. Solar is really on a tear in terms of its growth in our country. We had 40% of all the solar ever built happened last year in 2016, ever since we started commercializing solar panels in the 1970s. And we hit a milestone of 1 million solar installations last year. But the story is really about the future, too, because we're going to hit 2 million panels within just 2 years, after it takes us 40 years to get to 1 million. 4 million panels by 2020, and then by 2025, the projections are we're going to be installing 1 million solar installations every year. And it's really because comes down to really economics, where in many and increasingly most places all over the country, wind and solar are the cheapest new sources of generating capacity. You saw that also in the, again, in the marketplace last year. Solar was the top choice for people putting in new generation capacity, beat out all, just on economics, all the fossil fuels and every other source. You see the economics come to play in, on nuclear too, because importantly, you know, no one's ever going to build a new nuclear plant in the United States. It just doesn't pencil out. The only places in the world where they are being built is under heavy government subsidy. You might have one or two in Georgia, but you know, that's taking massive subsidies to get those built, and they're way over budget. So now we have, in terms of interesting times, we have a new administration that is empowering people who were completely on the fringe and radically against clean energy and trying to deny the economics, but I don't think they're going to win out. They'll try to do what they can. They might slow down the curve a little bit, but ultimately, I think in most of the analysis shows that we're going to continue going on. We might waste some money and some time in between, but if we are consistent and persevere and make a good case for how these are beneficial to the society and affordable, then I think we'll be okay.
Amit Ronan, where does the cost of a new PV photovoltaic installation stack up in terms of the electricity as opposed to fracked gas at this point in time?
Well, it's a little bit of apples and oranges, and even in the solar industry, there's so many different forms of solar generation. You can have it on a house's rooftop on a very small scale. You can have it on a big box store on a bigger scale, and you can have it on a utility scale where you have hundreds of thousands or already millions of panels. These are all the same commodity panel, but it's just how many you put in place. So that really affects the cost. The more you put in the same place, particularly in a sunny place, the cheaper you go. I think the best metric and the most interesting one is that we're seeing electricity at rates for some solar arrays at less than 4 cents a kilowatt hour, which easily beats pretty much any other fossil fuel source, even fracked gas, which is at extremely low prices now just because there's a large supply of it, but they still can't beat solar in that context.
And I assume that solar just runs rings now around coal.
Yeah, I mean, again, there's wholesale and retail markets, so it's complicated, and you know, coal has a lot of costs that they've already paid for. But if you're looking at new generation, again, nobody's going to build a coal plant because it doesn't make economic sense. They know the air pollution is bad. And again, we're not even counting. This is not an apples comparison because, you know, coal is using the atmosphere as a sewer for free. And so they're not paying their true costs of what it costs to generate electricity from coal. And that point was actually emphasized, unfortunately, early this week, because one of the things the Trump administration did to try and slow down this growth was not only kill the Clean Power Plan, but also they removed, this is wonky but important, there was a price on carbon that was effectively applied by the Obama administration called the social cost of carbon to every decision that the federal government made. They had to think about, well, what is this going to mean for air pollution and climate change? And they removed that cost adder to federal decisions in order, so, you know, because obviously that helps not who they want to help. But I think overall, we're still going to get there.
Pretty amazing, God. You know, you couldn't, if you wrote a novel and invented Donald Trump's energy policy, it would be dismissed as not credible. I mean, they're doing everything they can to. Let's go. Dan Jewell. Dan, you're with us from Northern.
Yep.
I got to say, point out that Amit and Scott are both in Washington, D.C. I'm in Los Angeles, and you
are in northern Minnesota. So how the hell is it up there?
It's beautiful. It's 60 degrees in March.
60 degrees?
Yeah, it's been crazy. The winters are crazy these days.
Yeah, such as they are. So give us your credential, and then tell us, if you would, about your work in wind power and where we're standing with wind. You were one of the great pioneers in the wind industry, and nobody knows more about it than you do. So tell us who you are and what's up with wind.
Okay, yeah. Well, I've started in northern Minnesota 40 years ago. I've been along about the same time as Scott, and I've been basically focused on community-based development. Over the years, I've developed over 400 megawatts of community-based projects in small clumps spread throughout the Midwest. We've got one in Ohio, where you used to be, Harvey, at the Honda plant there. We built that one at the Honda plant in Russell's Point. And so that's been our main focus, is doing community-based development. So most of our projects are someplace between 2 and 20 megawatts in size, and they're spread out all over. And that's kind of been our focus in the whole development stage of it. And you know, like you said, I've been involved with the technology since day one. When we first started building wind farms in California, I was involved in that with my friends in California. And then I came back to the Midwest in the late 80s, early 90s, and started developing here, built the first wind farms in the Midwest. Down to the Buffalo Ridge. Yeah, actually, they were the first wind farms out of California. And so it's been progressing since then. And we're involved in solar, too. We've been working with General Electric on developing a hybrid technology. We've taken the big 2.3-megawatt turbine with a 116-meter rotor on it, and we've taken the converter and adapted it to accept solar as an input to the converter. So we have one point of inversion to put power into the system, and that reduces the capital costs of everything. And so we put this together for community projects in packages of two turbines and 1 megawatt of solar in a package. And we can produce and deliver commercial scale energy for 3.5 to 4 cents a kilowatt hour in northern Minnesota with this technology. And so, you know, both Amit and Scott alluded to the fact that this is no longer just an environmental issue for everybody. This is a real economic issue, and we can produce and deliver power cheaper and cleaner. Also, on the technology working with the GE, we can accept a storage input. And so we're adding wind, solar, storage into a package, which is going to be really a game changer. And the build out of that whole idea is to identify, there's literally thousands of small substations outside of every community in the Midwest. And this technology, this package has been designed to be able to drop these things in and blend them into the system and not try to force power in like the big wind farms. They force power into the system and cause transmission issues, where this is more of a distributed model that puts commercial power into the system at very low costs, but we put the power in exactly where it's being consumed, right next to the load of the community. And so that's kind of where we've been and where we're going.
So how does the price that you deliver first of all, how many of these units have you built? Are you building one, right, at the moment?
Yeah, we've got three or four of them in the works. The GE technology just basically got UL certification just this spring, and so we're putting the first ones in the ground this spring. We're already in construction on one of them, and so this is just coming to the table. And you know, when we approached the utility on the first one, we told them we wanted to do avoided cost. And they went, our avoided cost is only 2 cents. You know, they've said that for years. And I said, well, if your avoided cost is 2 cents, how come I'm a ratepayer of paying 11.5? The math doesn't work. And
yeah,
so they blinked at
works
that.
For them.
And so I had to file a formal complaint at the Public Utilities Commission to get avoided cost. And we know that we can produce power cheaper and deliver it than they can. And
both admitted, Scott talked about that too, that we can, you know, the technology has evolved dramatically in the last few years. And with these large rotor turbines and the cost of solar, it's just a game-changing situation we're in. And now when we add storage to it, it's all over but the crying for them.
Well, I just want to point out to our mathematically impaired listeners that your rotor diameter there is well over the size of a football field. And how high in the air now are the nacelles on these things?
Some are 80 meters and some are 100 meters. And so that's 260 feet to 300 feet tall. So
okay,
they're up there a ways.
And so you are basically capable with this technology now of beating the any other source of electricity in cost. Is that right?
Any of them. Yeah. Well, we have no fuel, no emissions, no waste, no water, and no transmission costs. How do you not compete economically with that? You know.
And you're working with GE, who's probably dancing in the aisles now about the Westinghouse bankruptcy.
I haven't seen them do that yet, but.
Right. Although CA guys are all really great dancers from what I hear. So you and I co-authored a book many years ago, Harvesting Wind Power as a Cash Crop,
yep.
in which we predicted this kind of thing, and I guess our predictions have come true.
That's for sure. That's for sure. It just took a while to get, to get the technology. You know, it used to be we had to build the wind farms on top of the Buffalo Ridge and in these, out in the middle of North Dakota. But the technology has evolved with the low resource technology where we can put these machines in moderate wind resources and combine that with solar, and we can produce very cheap power.
And what? How big is the capacity of the unit that you're putting out there? The two windmills and the solar.
The wind turbine?
Your hybrid unit. What is the capacity?
Well, the total capacity of each package that we put together is basically two of the 2.3 megawatt wind turbines and 1 megawatt of solar. But you don't add those two capacities together, so you got two 2.3 megawatt turbines, so you got 4.6 megawatts of wind and 1 megawatt of solar. But when you interconnect into the system only sees the 4.6 megawatts because all of the energy flows through the wind turbine converter. Basically what it does is the solar just adds a daytime capacity factor to your energy sale with the wind. And that's really where the value is, because basically the wind produces power when there's low pressure, and the solar produces power when there's high pressure in the system. And they work really complement each other a lot. So,
well,
the total package is 4.6.
This is Scott, and I just want to say what makes wind and solar so wonderful, whether it's utility scale or community scale, is usually the wind's blowing in the late afternoon, early evening, overnight, while the sun obviously is up when it's sunny. Shocking. And when it's usually not sunny, many cases it's windy. So it allows, there's a natural capacity to blend solar and wind. And then, of course, if we add energy storage, whether that be pumped hydro or battery banks or flywheels or compressed air or liquids or hydrogen, you can make up any difference of what those two can't cover. And, of course, there's a whole other set of renewables as well. So the issue
sure.
is there's a wonderful natural capacity between wind and solar.
Well, yes. since having started in the anti-nuclear industry before you guys were born, I always think in terms of 1,000 megawatt nuclear plants. So let's say that you're sending out, Dan, to replace Prairie Island, and we'll put it at 1,000 megawatts. How many units that you've got here, and how much cost would be involved to completely replace a single 1,000 megawatt nuke?
Well, I suppose if you do 20 of these, you're doing about 100 megawatts, And so 200 of them would be that. And so, and it costs about $10 million a pop to put them in the ground. And that would include the storage. So it would be
about $2 billion.
Yeah,
is that right?
About $2 billion.
Is that the right
matter? Yep, $2 billion. Yep.
Well, that's, and how many people, how many jobs would that create?
Oh, hundreds of jobs.
Yeah,
I don't know exactly how many, but it would be a lot. I mean, it would be a lot of construction, a lot of ongoing maintenance operations, the development, the land rent, all of the things that go into the formula for a community is there. So it'd be a lot of jobs and a lot of local revenue out of it. But you have to remember that, you know, if you're going to build a nuke plant or any other plant, you're going to spend more than that building those plants. And then you still have fuel, you have emissions, you have waste. You have to get the power to the load because you have to get it by water, which, you know, you got all these other things. And so, I mean, we could produce commercial scale energy everywhere with this technology.
Wow. Okay, so now you have mentioned storage. Are you talking about batteries?
Yes. Well, we're looking at flow batteries, and then I like the zinc technology. There's a zinc hybrid technology, a company called EOS, which I really like, and ZAF, which is a zinc battery. And then there's a zinc flow battery. I like those because of the environmental benignness of the chemistry. Lithium ion's a great battery. I mean, it does a good job, and it does its thing. But I'm a little bit concerned about if we all start using mass quantities of lithium ion batteries, we're going to create a hazardous waste debacle. Because you know, that stuff's pretty bad after you're done using it. So, you know, we're kind of focusing on the benign technology, and the zinc batteries really look good to me. I like them a lot.
Amit, Ronan, you've been involved with battery technology. What do you think about that? Of course, we're celebrating to a certain extent the opening of the big giga factory in Nevada, the Solar City factory that's putting out batteries. What do you think about what's happening with batteries?
Yeah, I mean, there's a phenomenal growth in batteries, and that we're looking at a cost curve that is similar to the price drop that we saw in solar panels, maybe like 8 to 10 years later. So solar panels have dropped 80% the cost of buying one of these things, which is driving all the economics we were talking about earlier. And batteries are coming next. I think Dan made a good point about lithium ion batteries, and it would be nice to have a little diversity, but the reality is it's the lithium ion batteries that are dropping so fast because they can be used in multiple functions,
yeah.
Particularly, you know, your laptops, your EV vehicles. They're probably not the best choice for when you have a lot of space and you need a lot of electricity storage like you have in the electricity sector, but it's what's available in it, and it's becoming increasingly cheap. And it's the battery piece of this puzzle that really unlocks tremendous opportunities in terms of fundamentally changing the grid into a more distributed generation, integrating all these intermittent sources where you don't have to worry about when the wind is blowing and the sun is blowing, which has been one of the canards that the incumbents have been using to slow down the growth of renewables. And the part I'm most excited about, I think, is this distributed energy can empower individual users to generate their own electricity, and that they don't no longer need to rely on monopoly power that is basically the status quo everywhere in the country today.
I like how you use that term, incumbents. That's good. Scott Sklar, what do you got to say about batteries?
Well, I mean, first of all, I've used all kinds of batteries for the last 16 years in my projects around the world. I have battery banks in all three of my buildings. I work with 11 different kinds of battery materials. We are in a material science renaissance on batteries, from using quartz, the most common material, on down. I don't think there's any one right kind of battery. There are going to be many kinds. And frankly, I don't think you have to worry about whether it's lithium ion or anything else, because the battery industry will recycle their batteries. It's actually required by law. They want to do it. It's a lot less expensive to mine lithium out of an old battery than it is out of a mine. Every lithium ion company takes their batteries back and remanufactures with it. So I'm not worried about any of that. It will be totally recycled. It will be, we want to push battery material diversity. We are just beginning to see, remember, we don't buy car engines, we buy cars, and we don't buy refrigerator compressors, we buy refrigerators. And the real emergence is we're getting battery systems. And these are systems that are web-enabled, standardized, modular, interoperable, with performance diagnostics, financed, with service contracts. And it's not just Tesla with his Powerwall, but Johnson Controls, the largest battery manufacturer in the world, and Varta, one of the larger ones in Germany, and we have Stem, and we have a lot of battery companies coming in, and it's wonderful. And it's going to be easier for the customer, whether it's a utility customer, a commercial customer, a government customer, a residential customer, a remote customer, and it's going to be more reliable, and it's going to interface with on-site renewables, and all of it's good. So I'm very bullish. Battery costs have come down 50% over the last few years. It's going to come down another 25% in the next 3 years, and it's going to go lower than that. And with the cost of capital, feeling more comfortable with battery systems, the actual cost to the consumer will be way below what they're buying from a utility company. And if a utility company wants to put a standby charge so to prevent their solar customer, then you just bypass and say, I'm not going to give you any power. I'll just dedicate my solar system to my loads that I can handle. And I did that in my own house in 1985, before there were interconnection standards. So it's going to change the game, and that's what's so exciting.
Has the Gigafactory in Nevada actually started to put out product? Are they open?
I believe so. I believe I read that was its first. It's not the full operation level, but I believe they just ribbon cut a small manufacturing capacity. That's what I understand. Yeah. Amit,
do you know if they're open yet? In Nevada,
I believe Scott got it right. It's not completely built out, but it has some initial capacity coming through it.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
They're putting it out for their cars, not so much for the Powerwall, but for the cars that's coming up out of there.
Oh, all right. So the factory in Nevada is putting out car batteries now. I've read that it's supposed to be the biggest building in the world. Is that true?
That's what I've read.
Okay. Looks like it.
Yeah. So there's one detail I wanted to clear up here. I'm sure some of our listeners will be interested. I have heard that people are now taking old Prius batteries and using them to back up on their houses, because the theory being that the Prius battery needs to be a certain capacity to push the car, and then when it gets down, it's no good for the car, but it still has a useful life in a home. Have any of you guys heard that?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there might be a few folks doing it kind of entrepreneurially on their own. I think what's more interesting is there is going to be a market, and utilities are starting to dive into it on larger scale of accumulation of batteries that are no longer useful for cars, usually after they reach 80% of what they used to from when they were first used. They're no longer suitable for a car, but it's fine for a grid distribution node, and you just put up a bunch of these batteries, and they're essentially free because they've already been paid for by the person
driving the car. They got their value out of it. They're fully depreciated. So, but it's a great second life that you can use for these batteries, and it helps the grid, and it helps grid stability, helps bring down costs, helps mitigate peak demand. So I think it's a very promising model that it's going to be more available as more electric cars come on the market.
Dan Jewell, you've heard about that also?
Yeah, I have, but I think it's a tad bit of a slippery slope, because the lithium batteries, the deal is that in a car, when you step on the gas pedal, they want the thing to take off like a rocket, right? And so when the batteries get to the point where they don't have that giant inrush capability, then they move to the place where they can be used. But there's a bit of a slippery slope in the fact that you don't really know how many times have they been really deep cycled and what is their true life expectancy. And it puts more onus on the battery management system to keep the cells balanced, because if you get an unbalanced cell in a lithium battery pack, your battery management system will kick it out, and it doesn't work. And so, there's a bit of a slippery slope there, but as long as it's handled by professionals, I think it's a good thing. But it's like anything
All right.
else. It's used gear, so buyer beware.
Yeah. Right. So let's talk now. That's good to hear. Let's talk about electric cars now. Our fearless reader went to Detroit and told these guys to not worry about automobile standards. I mean, who's going to be buying these cars? Keep lowering the standards and all that. Scott, let's start with you. Where do we stand in the the transition to electric cars now? What's happening in the interface with renewables there?
Well, I mean, electric car sales are up, and what's amazing about this is, in historically, when oil prices were down, every time electric cars emerged, they crashed. And that is not what's happened in the last 5 years. Oil prices have been down, and electric cars are going up. And by the way, some of that has to do with the star power, frankly, of Elon Musk and Tesla, I have to say. But it is, what it's done is made the consumer more comfortable with that investment now. And frankly, everything else we have, our cell phones and our iPads and our laptops, all run on batteries now. So the public's a lot more comfortable. And so that's a wonderful news. I mean, that's really that's really wonderful. So I think the good news is electric cars are here to stay. Some markets like California, the Austin area, Texas, because the municipal utilities promoting it. Many state government vehicles now, universities are drawing on helping to prime the market, which is all great. And Austin was the first city that actually looked at and uses both hybrid plug-in vehicles and electric cars to interface with the utility grid. They have to have a lot of wind at night on their grid, and why not charge those batteries at night? And when those cars are parked at work or wherever, utility can dip in and pay the customer premium for some of that power. So it's all wonderful. I don't see any downside.
Well, of course, you have to remember that Elon Musk is an immigrant, so I assume Trump's going to deport him pretty soon.
Between Musk and me with the beard, you may have to get us over that wall that Mexico.
Yeah, I was thrown over the wall back into Mexico. Okay, Amit, what do you got to say about electric cars?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have reached a bit of a tipping point on electric cars. I mean, people have understood their promise for quite a while, but the choices for consumers were not there. But now we're at a point where there's still a very small segment of the vehicle fleet. As is, it's important to mention solar is still only 1% of the nation's electricity grid. So
We got a lot of long way to go. But with electric cars, every major manufacturer pretty much now has a offering. They're putting in billions of dollars in research to make them better. There's exciting options. There's some of the Tesla products that we mentioned. One of them is has the fastest production car ever made, faster than a Porsche or anything else. Yeah. By 2020, Volkswagen, the world's now largest vehicle manufacturer, they beat out Toyota for that top spot. They're going to have 20 models that are electric vehicles by 2020. Wow. So just in a couple of years, you're going to have huge amount of options. And Volkswagen, for example, is thinking ahead and says, well, we need, and they have an initiative to promote charging stations here in our country because people are going to need places to plug them in. And really the biggest hurdle besides education, and that is we're getting past some of the range issues, which have hampered their development and adoption by consumers who say, well, I don't want to be in a car that's can only go 80, 100, 140 miles. But now we're going to have new options where that's not the case. And when it comes to just pure economics, again, the prices are coming down fast. But more importantly, the operating costs are a fraction of what it is to run a gasoline engine, both in the fuel and certainly in the maintenance. There's almost no maintenance in an electric vehicle.
What is the comparable efficiency of an electric car versus a gas car? I know that's a broad question, but can you get a range on that?
Yeah, I mean, EPA worked several years to come up with a methodology that would enable to give essentially a MPG equivalent on electric vehicles. And it really varies a lot depending on the car, just like it varies in that. But, it's four or five times what it is for the MPG equivalent of a gas-powered vehicle.
That's astounding.
100
Dean,
per gallon, 130 mile per gallon is common. It is very important to note that, it matters where you get that electricity that's going into the car in terms of the balance on your emissions. If you're getting it straight from coal, it's not that great. It's a kind of a wash with gasoline. You're getting it from some of these renewable sources we're getting. Of course, it's great. It's phenomenal if you're generating power on your own roof and it's going to your car right there. You're in your own production loop there and taking care of a major energy source that's often overlooked.
Dan, is there a whole range of electric charging stations up there in northern Minnesota where we stand on electric cars?
Not yet, but it's funny what Amit just said, because when pretty-based development projects with these hybrids, part of the discussion is that we're laying the foundation for transportation fuel for rural America with these hybrids. And most folks that live up here, Harvey, you were at our place in Minnesota, and we're a good 10 to 20 miles from towns of size where you have to go get groceries and so on and so forth. And, electric cars would be perfect for running back and forth to town and running the errands that we need to do. And using a fossil fuel or a hydrocarbon car now is very expensive to do that, where if we can do it with electric cars, they're so much more economically to run. And, that's kind of the idea with developing these community-based hybrids, is not only can we produce power for our homes, but we can also produce transportation fuel to move our butts back and forth to town.
Well, I got to tell you, I had the incredible experience of riding in what must have been America's first electric pickup truck. It was Pete Seeger. He lived a few miles out of Beacon, New York, and he got an old pickup, and he tore out the gas engine and just filled it full of batteries. And he had exactly enough charge to get back and forth to town, and then he'd have to plug it back in. But that thing was really funky, and it did not have any kind of pickup whatsoever. It was like going in a Dodge car in an amusement park. But that must have been the first one. I don't know, Well, the question then, of course, Scott, are they going to start putting EV on the cars?
Well, actually, I have one of the, I have a 2010 Prius with the PV roof on it. And there are several electric car makers, including Tesla, that are going to integrate PV in it. It's not going to run the car totally. You know, it will either, so, by the way, many electric cars have more than one battery system, one to run air conditioning, one to deal with the startup, and then, of course, one to run the car. So my Toyota one runs the first two batteries, and then if they're full, it puts a little in the other one, but the main one. But yes, it's going to be very common on cars, and it will trickle charge your car. But in the end, we want solar canopies on parking lots and, of course, plug-ins off of solar-powered buildings and charging stations that bring in all the renewables, wind and geothermal and biomass and marine energy and solar of all types to do it. And I lived in Montana for a year in Butte, and they had plug-ins at every restaurant because they had block heaters. So it's not like we don't have places where, you know, cars are using electricity now. Obviously, they'll have to be upgraded. But we as Americans have done that for a long time.
We do that on a regular basis up here in Minnesota.
We got block heaters?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And are they going solar now? I mean, how's that working?
I don't know about solar block heaters, but all I was doing was using the analogy that as more electric car comes, you're going to have more plug-ins, and we've needed it in the north for block heaters, so it's not a crazy step to think we can't do it, accommodate electric vehicles.
For all my listeners who don't live in the great north, Dan, will you explain a block heater?
It's a heater that goes in the block of your car to heat it up, so when you get up in the morning to start your car, it doesn't go roar.
Yeah, well, it's not just in the morning. In Montana, it got, 15 below zero, and you could get after your dinner at the restaurant, and it wouldn't start either. So
Yeah.
Well, of course,
a block heater only uses about 500 watts, so we'd have to upgrade the system a little bit, Scott, to make it charge a car. So.
Yes, sir. That's true.
Well, Amit,
we can do it.
Amit, yeah. Being the youngest among us, is there a movement on to put PV cells on cell phones and laptops and things like that? I mean, I'm walking around with these cell phones. I'm wondering why they don't have PV on them.
Well, I have to tell you, I do tours here in my buildings, and I must have 60. Solar gadgets, and I'd say 15 of them are either solar cell phone chargers or solar laptop chargers. I use them all the time. So I think you need to jump into the 21st century here and buy some of these gadgets.
All right. We can do that. Amit, is all your stuff solar powered?
I got an electric motorcycle, which gets me around town, which is a pretty good ride in the city. Manufactured here in West Virginia. Crick must have created a few jobs there. I mean, it doesn't – just because solar panels can go on a lot of things doesn't mean that it necessarily makes that much sense. You want to be – there's no difference if you get an electron off from a solar panel if it's on your roof and you plug it in a charger and charge your battery that way, or put it on your phone. Might be nicer not to carry something around. But the key is, there's a lot of different options. Wind is awesome and can produce a lot of power, but solar is really the most scalable technology. You can go from very small applications to just enormous multi-billion-dollar facilities that we've seen, and that's part of the exciting trend of it, and people are getting more innovative as markets open up. There's innovation happening on the financing side, on the deployment side, on the technology side. And for so many years, there was always this notion that, if we just had this breakthrough in renewable technology or, some special chemistry or material would come out, then all our problems would be solved. But I think the story here in the last couple of years. This 80% drop in solar panel prices really came from scale, and it wasn't some breakthrough. It was that in this case, a lot of it was the Chinese government decided to put in $50 billion in solar manufacturing. The German government decided to buy a bunch of panels. So there was a huge scale factories that were built. When they started cranking them out, they learned by doing it. And that's what dropped the price. And that's kind of the vision of what Elon Musk is trying to do with his gigafactory. He knows that if he cranks out, the more he cranks out of these, the more less they'll cost per unit. And he doesn't have to invent the, you know, some breakthrough battery, but he'll be able to do it with basically the same kind of battery that they're making today.
Well, do we have, you know, the Chinese, my understanding of how it works is the Chinese tried to corner the world market. They did drive Solyndra and a bunch of other people out, but they did not succeed. They wound up with a bunch of surplus panels that they decided to put up around China, maybe to help fight the air pollution. And now they're going to put in $360 billion by 2020. So the question is, can the American PV industry compete with the Chinese? Dan, are you using American panels in your hybrid unit?
Yeah, we are. We're using Solar One panels in the hybrid. I believe we're getting GE's bringing the panels in as part of the hybrid system. But you know, it's going to be awful tough to compete one on one with what the Chinese are doing. But I think it does have, you know, the lessons learned from what they've done in China. If we adopt some of those lessons here, it'll keep our prices down. And you know, I just think that, you know, we live in a global commodity market on a lot of different levels, and solar panels should be no different. The value to us as U.S. energy consumers is that if we can produce power cheap, that's the big value. The manufacturing of the solar cells can create a few jobs, but the real value is that it's cheap energy. And so I think we should look to source our panels to wherever we can get them the cheapest, because as we can get cheap panels, we get cheap energy. If we have cheap energy, it's better for our economy.
Yeah, two additional thoughts on that. There's certainly a global supply chain for solar equipment, all the things that go into a module. So Chinese really focused on module manufacturing, which is assembly into these squares that people recognize. But there's polysilicon coming from all over the world, which is a base component of PV panels. There's films that are produced here because they're higher value products and then shipped
and
over. So that's all for the good.
Big...
Well, one other point, Scott, sorry, is on the jobs, which is we've referenced a couple times. I mean, the number of jobs in the solar industry we're familiar with because we've been involved with the solar job census the last couple of years. 1 in 50 jobs in the entire United States last year came in the solar industry. 1 in 50 jobs. And that growth, 90% of that growth was in solar installation. So people putting it up on the roofs of their local community homes, jobs that can't be outsourced. So that's a phenomenal growth rate, and it's expected to continue in the future.
Yeah.
And in fact, the solar industry alone, there's more in the wind, but there's 250,000 Americans employed in solar, and that's more than what is used in electric generation of oil, gas, coal, and nuclear combined.
I just read an article that said that there's more jobs in renewable energy in every state in the union than there is in fossil fuels.
Yeah,
every state has more solar and renewable jobs in fossil fuels, which is pretty
amazing.
Overwhelming,
yeah.
Really.
We're going to run out of time here. Dan, will you tell people where they can get a hold of you and see your project?
Say that again, Harvey?
Give us your website where you want people to go to see what you're doing.
JewelEnergy.com.
And Amit?
We're at solar.gwu.edu.
And Scott?
Well, instead of giving my website and my company, if anybody has any questions or has wants to see my 32 studies I give to my GW students to familiarize.
Hurry up.
For the efficiency renewables, go to solarflar at AOL.com.
Okay, you guys, thank you so much. This is a great show. I got a piece up an Eco Watch, and we'll send you the URL, and we'll see you in Solartopia. We're going to have a Solartopia.